Councillor, Lib Dem councillor, in fact, for Knowle here in Bristol. After the news, drugs.
He was jailed for 5.5 years. The 30-year-old, who ran off to France with a pupil half his age, admitted 5 charges of sexual activity with a child the day after being convicted of abduction. Defence lawyer Henrietta Ronson spoke on behalf of Forrest's parents, Jim and Julie, on the steps of Lewis Crown Court.
Jeremy is very sorry for his actions. Despite the verdict and today's sentence, there are many factors in this case which need to be examined and addressed, including the failure to properly act and early warnings. We sincerely hope that these are sensibly looked into and not simply swept under the carpet.
The Health Secretary is to make it a criminal offence for anyone in the NHS to deliberately mislead the public over safety incidents. It follows failings by the Care Quality Commission at Furness General Hospital in Cumbria. Jeremy Hunt's also considering stripping former executives of their pensions if they're found guilty of a cover-up. NHS whistleblower Gary Walker thinks that's a step too far.
I'm not sure about the pension stripping, but I certainly think that there are potentially criminal actions. If you hide some information that can be seen to cause harm, then clearly you have contributed to that position.
UK government lawyers have travelled to Portugal to visit their counterparts to discuss new leads in the case of missing Madeleine McCann. The little girl, who was then nearly 4, disappeared from her family's holiday apartment in Praia da Luz in 2007. Google has been given 35 days to destroy personal data collected by its Street View cars or face criminal proceedings. The Information Commissioner's Office is demanding the internet search giant deletes 4 disks of information it collected from unsecured wireless networks. The editor of The Sun is leaving to take up a new role in News Corp. Dominic Moen's replacement is the former head of the Scottish Sun, David Dinsmore. And in tennis, Andy Murray will play Germany's world number 95, Benjamin Becker. That's the latest. I'm Chloe Culpin.
BCFM.
We're going to the zoo on Saturday, the 22nd of June. BCFM is joining forces with Radio WOMAD to bring you 5 hours of live broadcast from WOMAD at the zoo. So tune to BCFM on 93.2 between 6 and 11pm on Saturday, the 22nd of June. And here's something you've not heard before. It's better than going to the pub.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The police have lost the war on drugs and organised crimes growing in Bristol and other cities by the day. So will Bristol take the lead in ending prohibition and controlling drugs rather than pretending the problem doesn't exist? Plus more on organised crime, this time the City of London. Rowan Bosworth Davis joins us on the line to discuss the Parliamentary Commission on Banking Culture, which delivered its report this week. He believes the City of London, and he's a former Fraud Squad detective, is an organised criminal enterprise. And the Bilderberg fallout. The public looks like it has to foot the majority of the £1.3 million bill for this private conference of royalty and banksters. So why should we? Well, we start this week by having a look round the world's hotspots. Martin, I suppose the first one's got to be the G8 conference and the communique over Syria. A bit of a compromise.
Well, not really. Different views about what to do. It looks like the whole thing about sarin being used by the government was basically set up. I mean, there's no real evidence of it whatsoever. No, the UN and various other people have got...
This is starting to sound a bit like Iraq, isn't it?
It is. But of course, think about the timing. They knew that Putin would be coming to the G8 in Northern Ireland, and so they set up this whole thing where to bully him into supporting their policy, because apparently the government had used sarin, although in actual fact all the evidence now suggests there's at least 2 lines of evidence, including the Turkish police raiding an Al-Nusra Front cell in Turkey and finding sarin. So in actual fact, it's the rebels who are using sarin. Now, if the rebels are using sarin, and the government using sarin is such a red line to cross that we've got to go to war, if the rebels are using sarin, perhaps we should go to war with them, which is the sort of thing that Putin was saying.
Okay, and he was also saying, wasn't he, that these rebels rip people's hearts out. They're like cannibals. This was a bit of a cheeky thing to say in Downing Street.
Well, I think he was unwise to focus on that particular incident, because there's lots worse incidents he could have focused on. But I think most people have understood quite clearly the government of Syria are not very nice people. And the people fighting to overthrow them, they're not very nice people either. And in fact, ordinary people are just getting mashed up like in a car crash.
Well, there was a discussion this week, I think it was Tuesday, in the Commons with William Hague, the Foreign Secretary, discussing whether or not there would be a Syria vote. What's your thought about that? Because this is obviously quite important. Will there be a vote before there's any kind of British troops committed committed to Syria?
The fact is that evidence is overwhelming that MI6 and British Special Forces have been training these rebels all along. So they're having a big argument about should we train and arm the rebels. In actual fact, they are already training and arming the rebels, and they just want us to rubber stamp what they're already doing.
For example, the RAF overflying and putting in a no-fly zone. They're saying they want to have a Commons vote about that.
Well, a no-fly zone is another ratchet up the escalation ladder, because of course the Syrians will try and shoot down any planes that cross into their airspace, as they've already done with one Turkish.
Well, let's go back to the House of Commons again then, Tuesday this time, and this is the Labour former Defence Minister Peter Hain, then you'll hear William Hague, and finally Speaker Burko.
British planes policing a no-fly zone and possibly bombing anti-aircraft installations of the Syrian government, and also training, which could be training on the ground. Could I ask him to confirm, so that this quote that was in the Sunday Times on Sunday, a senior Tory source said, the bottom line is that we will avoid at all costs a vote, as we don't think we can win it.
I think my right-hand friend, the Prime Minister, and I have made the position very clear, so I don't think he needs to look at a senior Tory source in any... there aren't any more senior Tories than the Prime Minister, who has said... occasionally one or two may think they are, but there aren't any more senior Tories than the Prime Minister. And he has made very clear that on this issue, on these issues, the government has a strong record in holding votes in the House of Commons when it's necessary to do so. We certainly wouldn't want to pursue any policy, any aspect of our policy in this, against the will of the House of Commons.
That would obviously be the democratic course. I'm not sure that there was any other idea ever in their minds, but I feel sure that if it was in their minds, it was speedily expunged from them as undemocratic and indeed inappropriate.
The Foreign Secretary was nodding vigorously during your remarks.
He and others will take that as an explicit commitment by the Foreign Secretary that there will be no implementation of such a decision without the prior assent in the form of a vote on a substantive motion in this House of Commons. Yeah. I think we're now clear.
So, are you clear, Martin?
Well, what I'm clear about is that there's evidence that they've already been training and arming these rebels. So when they turn up in the House of Commons and say, we won't do anything without asking you, I just don't believe them. Sorry, I just don't believe them.
Okay.
They don't necessarily know what's going on themselves, even if they are the Prime Minister.
Also, the nearby Iranian elections, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, that actually looks quite positive, because the fellow who's run Rouhani has got a mandate. He's the only cleric, in fact, that stood, so he's got a religious background. And all reports of this chap are that he's a very hard negotiator, but very fair and reasonable. So this could actually work. If the West picks up, takes a constructive attitude, this could actually be quite... one of the things they could do, for example, is invite him to go along to this Syria meeting that they've organised in Geneva. But apparently that's already been ruled out, so that's... The chance of getting things sorted has already been kicked into touch.
But hasn't he sent some troops into Lebanon from Iran?
No. That's claimed by others. Hezbollah have crossed the border from Lebanon into Syria, and this just reminds us that these borders were drawn by the imperial powers at the end of the First World War, and they don't actually mean much. And once we've actually got to a situation in Iraq where the borders, we're talking about splitting the state into three bits, as the neocons used to do, this is a Pandora's box, and once you open it, there's no shutting it. And the real danger now, I fear, is that people are backing themselves into corners and refusing to lose face, and we could end up with a war that nobody wants just because nobody wants to be seen to be backing down.
Well, at least
it's absolutely absurd and ridiculous.
At least there'll be a vote about it.
Well, so they say. What happens if the war breaks out because somebody attacks somebody? Will there be a vote about it? There won't be a vote about it. What these people are, they're like King Canute saying that they can hold back the tide. I don't actually believe that they are in charge of what's going on. Let's face it, people like the CIA and the Qataris and the Saudis are already arming their protégés, and nothing the British House of Commons says either way is going to make a blind bit of difference to that.
OK, Martin, thank you. And we're joined on the line now by Rowan Bosworth-Davies. Hi, Rowan, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Now, Rowan, you are a former Fraud Squad officer. I believe it was 12 years you did in Scotland Yard, is that right?
Yep.
Now, we've had this Parliamentary Commission on Banking this week that's reported, and I'm really interested to see what you make of it, because some of the things that you were pointing out on this show a month and a half ago, was it roughly 2 months ago, that you were talking about, that much of what's going on in the City of London is identical in definition to an organised criminal enterprise, and they have now, Andrew Tyrie's committee have now reported that this is what they want. They want actual criminal prosecutions and possibly jailing of bankers.
Well, that's what they say, but from my perspective, I think this is really a piece of smoke and mirrors, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, they've now finally come out and said, yes, it's really important that we jail bankers, but I genuinely believe that this is just a headline to capture the attention of the public prints, because in fact when you dissect, as when you apply a lawyer's mind to this potential charge, and you try and dissect exactly what it is they're saying they want, all they're doing is talking about a situation we already have laws in this country which would enable bankers who behave recklessly to be prosecuted. We've had them for years, and no one's ever bothered to use them. And now they're saying, oh, well, we've got to have all these new important laws. But when you actually look at what it is they're saying in how these laws are going to work, the way in which they've created, or they're proposing to create this law, makes it even more difficult to prosecute bankers than it would do under the existing law.
Well, this was brought up by the Labour leader Ed Miliband at Prime Minister's Question this week, so let's just have a short clip of that.
Mr. Speaker, following the Parliamentary Commission on Banking, can the Prime Minister confirm that he supports its important recommendations on bonuses and criminal penalties, and that he will use the Banking Bill to implement them?
Yes, I do support both those measures. Obviously, we need to take time to read this excellent report, and I commend my honourable friend, the member for Chichester, for the excellent job that he's done. But penalising, including criminal penalties, against bankers who behave responsibility, I say yes. Yes, and also making sure that banks who are in receipt of taxpayers' money that you can claw back and abandon bonuses, I say yes to.
Well, what he seems to be saying there, Rowan, is that what we need is this new banking bill to be altered. In fact, Ed Miliband is saying that, not David Cameron. So are you saying effectively that this is some kind of silly ruse, that there's no need for any kind of new legislation?
I'm not saying it's a silly ruse. I'm saying that what I'm saying is it's the same old. It's what always happens. You know, government gets itself into a complete bind over something. So they've got to be seen to be doing something. So the first thing they do is set up a huge commission, which takes forever to consider its facts. Although when people like me present evidence to it and ask to be allowed to come and give evidence to them, it's interesting how they studiously avoid inviting me to come along and, in fact, lose my report. But then, at the end of the day, after the city lobbyists have been able to get in there and make their, you know, lobby the various members of the committee and suggest ways of dealing with things, we eventually come out with this proposal, which is, okay, because everyone's been talking, everybody in the press, the media's been saying, this organised criminality has got to be dealt with.
This organised criminality, though, Rowan, just remind us, what links have you made between the behaviour of the banks, I mean, particularly over the money laundering we heard about earlier on, HSBC, and the LIBOR fraud, which was went across many banks? In what way is that, and the behaviour after that, in any way identical to an organised criminal enterprise, as you said?
All you have to do, I mean, I can't quote them off the top of my head, but all you have to do is apply any of the standard tests or definitions of organised crime. And when I put my report into the commission, I quoted four different definitions of organised crime: one from Australia, one from America, one from Europe, and one from the UK. About ongoing enterprises where two or more people come together to make money using criminal methods in an ongoing process where the ultimate end game is to make criminal profits for themselves. I mean, that's a general sort of bringing together of all the. But however you submit the definitions, and then you look at what's been going on in the city, whether it's in the PPI mis-selling, or this dreadful phrase mis-selling, this PPI fraud, whether it's in the use of setting like HSBC setting up money laundering operations in Mexico, whether it's in the gross manipulation of the LIBOR market, these are people coming together to commit crimes to make profits for themselves. This is organised crime. It's very simple. You know, this isn't rocket science.
What about specific laws that police could use to arrest bankers?
We've got plenty of those. Even the report itself admits that this country is stiff with laws that they could have used to deal with these people. You could use, there are offences under the Theft Act they could have used against these people manipulating these LIBOR offences. There are offences under the Fraud Act. We've got to be very careful here because somebody's now been charged with conspiracy to defraud. So we have to be very, very careful how we deal with this. We simply mustn't say too much about it because we could be all over the coals. But there are plenty of offences that already exist in this country to have dealt with every single kind of criminality that's been identified in what's been going on in the city. The fact of the matter is that nobody's had the bottle to go out there and do it. The regulators have specifically and systematically refused to exercise their criminal powers to deal with. They've even done it. Look, as of yesterday, we've been through all this brouhaha of everything's going to change, everything's going to be different now. Yesterday in the Daily Telegraph, there's a story about a financial advisor who's been dealt with by the new FCA for basically stealing nearly £1 million from his clients. And they fined him. But he hasn't been prosecuted. He hasn't been charged with any criminal offences. And this is exactly where we've gone back to. This is exactly the same mess that the Financial Services Authority was making.
Well, that's how I understand it, Rowan. I mean, you probably would be able to tell me if this is right or not as a former detective. All you have to do is go to a magistrate with evidence that an offence has been committed, and then you can get a warrant for an arrest. Isn't that not right?
In theory, that's okay. But in practice, no private citizen is going to have the, without skills and ability, is going to have the wit or the wisdom or indeed the put their money at risk to start doing this. But I mean, there's no reason why they can't go to the police and make these allegations. And I would encourage anybody who's been caught up in this kind of thing to go to their local police station and make an allegation of fraud.
You're talking about the PPI and the interest rate swaps, this kind of thing?
Yes, exactly. And you see, what's happened here is, but of course we've got so many agencies now in this country that have been brought together to deal with issues of fraud and financial crime, and everybody passes the buck to everybody else.
Well, that's exactly what the guy was saying from Cumbria, wasn't it, about the Care Quality Commission, that there was so many players on the field it was impossible to actually get anything done.
Well, that's part of the problem that exists in this country, whether we're dealing with financial crime, whether we're dealing with issues like this Care Quality Commission. I mean, on Newsnight last night, or on one of the television programs last night, they were whittling on about, how are we going to deal with anything? What are there any charges that we could bring against these people in the Care Quality Commission? I would submit there's a perfectly fine charge that exists in English criminal law as an offence called affecting a public mischief. And they could bring an investigation, not saying they would necessarily bring charges, but they could investigate. Just listen to this. This is the definition of a public mischief. A person is guilty of a public nuisance who does an act not warranted by law, or B, omits to discharge a legal duty if the effect of the act or omission is to endanger the life, health, property, morals, or comfort of the public, or to obstruct the public in the exercise or employment of rights common to all Her Majesty's subjects. Now, I would submit to you that it wouldn't take an you don't need to be a rocket science genius to be able to go and investigate what was going on. When people start covering up reports that have been put in showing that concerns are being raised, I would have no personal qualm about making an investigation into that to see whether there's enough evidence to submit a charge of affecting a public nuisance.
Well, it's always easy to lay blame in these sorts of cases, but isn't it the fact, Rowan, that actually the problem here is largely with the police? I mean, we saw, for example, with the phone hacking scandal, that it took many, many years, actually, from the police having the evidence of this phone hacking for it ever to reach such a public furore in the press for them to press charges.
I'm not going to try and defend what the police did over the phone hacking case. That's what was going on there was frankly, I mean, we've got to be careful because there are charges pending on this. I'm not proud of how my former colleagues handled that, and I'm not going to try and pretend I am. And it certainly demonstrated that there was a lot of unhappy activity, and I won't put it any higher than that, going on inside there, because the relationship between policemen and newspaper moguls and God knows what else, I'm not proud of that. That doesn't mean to say that there aren't police agencies in this country who don't have the morality and the wit and the ability to be able to deal with these kinds of fraud cases. The problem is that the moment you go to the police to do this, they'll turn around to you and they'll say, oh, unfortunately, we'd like to help, but in fact, you have to report this to the Financial Conduct Authority. And that's what's going to happen. Everybody's passing the buck.
Yes, too many players on the field again.
Too many players on the field.
Yeah. Okay, over the there is another offence, isn't there, which is misconduct in public office. Interesting, I was looking that up the other day.
Misconduct in public office.
Which I think is malfeasance, something like that, where actually I was quite surprised to see, even for an omission, someone in a public position like that can actually be put in jail for life, simply for an omission.
It's an old common law offence. Again, we have to be careful how we define these things. It's an old common law offence for which the ultimate punishment is life imprisonment. I mean, it's like sort of arson in Her Majesty's dockyards and taking a ship in navigable waters. These are really old common law offences which no doubt would, if charged, no doubt the judge and the prosecutors would come to a tariff which would not, I doubt very much, would involve someone being sentenced to life imprisonment. It's a dangerous area to get into, Tony.
You say, don't you, that your criticism was of one of the Daily Mail headlines after the Banking Commission report came out. It said, greedy bankers are to face prison as the Chancellor prepares a new law to target reckless bosses who take risks with the economy. But what you're effectively saying is actually there is all the ammunition there to do the job. And why is it that the job is not being done? This is one sort of almost obstacle that we come up against again and again. What would you like to see happen to actually start to move on the bankers? We're talking about Mervyn King, for example, recently saying that we must stop bashing the bankers. I mean, many people would say actually there hasn't really been any real bashing of bankers, i.e. no proper charges against the people in charge of these banks. A few small minnows possibly, but none by the people who are profiting, and also out of court settlements rather than coming to court. So have you got any thoughts about other than ordinary citizens going to hand evidence to the police that you were just talking about that might actually move this forward?
I have lots of thoughts about these things, and I have written about them. I have written about them for days and for weeks and months and years now. But this whole issue comes down to, in my opinion, it comes down to an issue where you've got situation where the government, to be perfectly frank with you, the government is absolutely terrified of facing up to these bankers, because if the truth be known, the government really cannot, and I genuinely believe, I've got to the stage where I believe that the government genuinely cannot move against the city because it's too powerful, and the city has got the government over a barrel. And when the, you know, I used to believe, there was a time I used to believe that when the bankers used to threaten the government and say, well, if you don't stop bashing us, we'll move our business elsewhere. And I used to say, yeah, go on, do it, for, you know, front them down. Truth of the matter is, from my perspective now, I genuinely believe the government daren't. Because the city is responsible for delivering, generally speaking, about 11%, a contribution to about 11% of our GDP. And if the city decided it wasn't going to contribute that anymore, because this isn't something they do because they want to. This is something they do because it suits them in that sense. And then they tell the government, you know, we would rather you kept your nose out of our affairs. So, you know, please don't take the money, but stop asking too many questions about how we make the rest of our money. And I've reached the stage now, I wrote in an article recently, I said, it's no longer a question about the government is controlling the city. The city, the financial city, is the government. And that's why I genuinely believe we're not seeing any prosecutions brought against these people, because the city's made it perfectly clear we're not prepared to put up with all this. We're not prepared to be prosecuted, see our senior people are sent to prison. It's got nothing to do with you. Keep your nose out of our affairs and just keep picking up the money and everyone will be happy. I'm afraid after all these years, after saying this stuff for so long, that is the I'm afraid, the rather shocking conclusion I've come to.
Well, Rowan Bosworth Davis, your website is rowans-blog, that's rowans-blog.blogspot.co.uk. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Nice to talk to you.
Drive Time on BCFM
93.2. Well, would you like to comment on that, Martin? That's pretty shocking, hearing from a former detective from Scotland Yard that actually the city is the government. I mean, what are we voting for?
Well, I mean, Peter Galbraith, who's J.K. Galbraith's son in the US, has been pushing very hard for prosecutions on Wall Street. And if the political situation is such that they can't be prosecuted, you know how this is going to play out. The stuff they're doing is so silly, they're going to crash the world economy. The banks will collapse, they will walk away with the loot, we will pick up the pieces. And at the end of all of that, after we've had, you know, civil war in Syria, breaking out into civil war in Britain, civil war in Venezuela, civil war in Brazil, civil war in Turkey, lots of people will die, and at the end of that, lots of bankers will be dead too. That's what it's going to be like.
Ultimately, though, what about these forms of prosecution that Rowan was talking about? He gave us various acts of parliament there, simple acts of parliament that could be used against them today for arrests.
It saddened me to hear Ed Miliband just giving the Prime Minister an underarm ball there early, saying...
Yeah, wanting the banking bill. Maybe we could adjust the banking bill.
I mean,
no.
The fact of the matter is that the existing law has been broken with impunity. And if you live in Latin America, it's what they call impunidad. There is a law, but the rich don't obey it. Now, ultimately, of course, we need a rule of law. I mean, we've had a 30-year civil war in Northern Ireland, which has ended in a peace treaty based around the concept of the rule of law. Now, the problem is, if there is no rule of law, then it's a war of all against all, and bankers die like everybody else dies, as the IRA worked out in the 90s when they planted the bomb in Bishopsgate, which actually forced the British government to negotiate. That's where you go when you haven't got a law.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, on to the week before last's Bilderberg conference. Just a brief respite from it, Martin, a bit of a debrief. George Osborne has come clean today about Bilderberg, apparently. This is in the Digital Journal, an article by Alexander Barron. How do we know what our leaders do at these Bilderberg meetings? Well, we could always write and ask them. George Osborne has replied to his letter, essentially saying that although it was a private meeting, George Osborne went on his own, but it was paid for by the Treasury.
Well, it's not a private meeting then, is it? It's the usual doublethink. It's either a private meeting and therefore you pay yourself, or the Treasury pays for you to go, in which case it's not a private meeting and we want to see a minute of it.
Now, this Bilderberg conference really contains the biggest... I mean, we've got royalty in there, the bankers from all of the central banks, including things like the World Bank, the IMF, the European Central Bank, all the major banks in the Western world, in the NATO countries, plus royalty, plus the oil companies, most of the oil companies anyway, plus a new thing this week has been largely... not this week. This year has been a lot of defence companies, the two major biggest British defence companies, in fact yes, the biggest in Britain and the biggest in Europe, EADS and BAE Systems, both in this meeting chatting with George Osborne, with Ed Balls, with Peter Mandelson, with the Chancellor of Exchequer George Osborne, and the Prime Minister David Cameron.
Well, exactly. And I mean, if it looks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, if it swims like a duck, it is a duck. Basically, the politicians are there to be given their instructions by the criminal financiers. That's the bottom line. Now, at some point, we've got to get a democracy in this country. We haven't really got one. We elect people to run the city here, and it turns out they've got no power. Meanwhile, the central government just takes its instructions from the bankers and from the military-industrial complex. The situation is actually very, very serious. It's 5 minutes to midnight, folks.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
And it took place in Bristol the month before last at the Malcolm X Centre. It was the first AGM of a cannabis legalisation campaign called Normal, N-O-R-M-L. There's a lot of people now saying, well, I mean, including myself and many others I speak to, are saying, well, actually, the police have lost the battle. It's not that they're losing the battle. They've lost the battle to stop illegal drugs being distributed.
Well, it also links back to the banking crisis we were talking about earlier. I keep mentioning this, but there's a 2009 report by the UN Commission on Drugs and Crime, which is basically senior police officers around the world, and they said during the banking crisis of 2008, the drug cartels just turned up with their dirty money on the doorsteps of the banks and just washed it all in one go. So all kinds of controls over money laundering and everything went out of the window. If we're talking about survival here, then we'll take money from anybody. So the banking system is propped up by the taxpayer and the drug cartels. We've still got drugs illegal all over the world, which is leading to all sorts of conflicts and violence, because, you know, if somebody rips you off in the drugs trade, you can't go to the police. You have to go and sort it out with a baseball bat at the low level or the machine gun at the high level, which is what's leading to all these deaths and destruction in places like Mexico. And the Latin American countries are coming together, and they are going to tell the Americans in a very short period of time, we are going to legalise drugs. You can do what you like, but we're going to legalise them, because they cannot carry on down the road we're in. Now, ending prohibition, if we were to do it, could have all sorts of positive impacts. But don't forget, the people making money from this are actually quite happy for the situation as it is, whether they're bankers or drug dealers. The situation as it is what they want to see.
Martin, how does this actually affect things here on the street in Bristol then?
You've got lots of people using drugs in Bristol, as they do all in other parts of the world. Then basically not necessarily criminal people, but they just happen to use drugs. But of course, the only way they can get their drugs is by dealing with criminal people, and the criminals make the money, and then the criminals use the money to pursue their criminal pursuits, all of which then gets washed through the banking system, so they get they're quite happy with it. And ultimately, of course, it just leads to all kinds of problems. And that's not to say that making drugs legal solves the problem of the fact that drugs are not very good for you. I mean, everybody knows that. They've known it all along, but it's never stopped anybody, not in the tens of thousands of years human beings have been around. Virtually every single civilization has used drugs, and this one is included in that.
Well, I've been struggling with the technology, and I finally won, I hope. Fingers crossed. Here's Tom Lloyd, former Chief Constable of Cambridgeshire.
My name's Tom Lloyd. I'm the former Chief Constable of Cambridgeshire and spent 25 years working in London. And after that experience, in the years since my retirement about 8 years ago, I'm absolutely of the view that prohibition is a very expensive, harmful, counterproductive failure. I spend my time now as an international drug policy advisor, doing what I can to challenge prohibition and to bring about a regulated and controlled system by governments rather than criminals, seeking reform so that we end prohibition, we move towards a medical approach to drugs, we have proper education, we don't have emotion and fear about change interfering with what really now is a very urgent and pressing issue. We have criminals making $320 billion a year, it's estimated, it could be an underestimate, out of the illicit drugs market. And of course what they do is produce drugs. You've heard of the concept of the drug pusher, and they push them at children, they push them at anybody else that they can get to take them, because they are driven purely by profit. This is a highly unsatisfactory state of affairs. So I do what I can, and the reason I'm in Bristol is that clearly I support the legalization of cannabis. Cannabis is not as powerful as other substances, and I believe that the regulation of and control of drugs ought to be proportionate to the strength of the drug involved. So something like heroin would be very closely regulated and controlled, but something like cannabis would have far fewer restrictions. I think it's also important to realise that where cannabis is concerned, there are proven medical benefits, and there are people at this conference, the first annual general meeting of Normal UK, has people here who are passionate about the need to change the law because they suffer from very debilitating medical conditions.
But Tom, you're a former chief constable, you're supposed to be a policeman that upholds the law as it exists. It sounds to me as if you're holding up your hands and saying, well, as police, we've just given up. We can't regulate this industry, we can't arrest enough people, there's always going to be drugs on the streets. And have you actually given up?
Well, it's not a question of giving up. It's a question of looking at what the original intentions were and thinking about what the best way to deal with it is. Have the police or law enforcement around the world, let alone the UK, been successful? Clearly not. Drug consumption has increased substantially, dramatically, in the 40 years of the modern war on drugs. Many, many more harmful substances are now available than natural substances, like, for example, cannabis. Huge profits made by criminals who corrupt and undermine whole countries. I mean, this has simply been a hugely costly failure. So there's absolutely nothing wrong in changing your approach when you are faced with facts that say that your current method of trying to deal with the harms, and there are harms associated with drug consumption, when those methods have clearly failed.
Now, is there anything that's informed you, particularly on this subject, in your career in policing?
Well, I do remember as a young constable, and this is in the 1970s, seeing men and women, often quite young, perhaps teenagers as well, would collapse from accidental overdoses, and they overdose because when the criminals are in charge of the supply, you don't know what concentration or contamination you're getting. And these people were just thrown into a room called a pit in the Central Middlesex Hospital on my beat. And that seemed to me then, all those years ago, to be quite the wrong way to dealing with people. Somebody's son, daughter, brother, sister, mother, father. These are human beings and they need help. They don't need criminalisation. And I've been in charge of major drug operations where over 100 dealers were taken off the streets in a big swoop, and yet hours, days, weeks later the market goes back to what it was, because there are people there who want the drugs, and because of the financial advantages the market will very quickly adapt and will supply those drugs. So it is rather like shoveling water. You can work very hard at it, but it's just going to keep on flooding back.
Actually, I'll put it to you that really it's your failure as police, the bad tactics that you've used, really not taking out the major suppliers, international suppliers, going for the low-hanging fruit, that's caused the rise in the use of drugs.
And interestingly enough, the police have tackled it at all levels, and I don't just talk about the UK, because my experience goes wider, and this whole issue, of course, is wider than what happens in the UK. But certainly the idea of arresting, say, 2 million cannabis users today, or for that matter, fewer users in the past, hasn't worked in the UK. There have been arrests, I've made them myself, and it hasn't worked in other countries. You look at the level of enforcement and arresting going on in America, at the moment, huge effort at trying to deal with users by way of law enforcement completely failed. There's much higher levels of drug consumption there, and this happens in many other countries. As far as major international criminals are concerned, they're making $320 billion a year. It's estimated that law enforcement is spending $100 billion a year. And frankly, law enforcement is outgunned, outmaneuvered. I mean, it's not that difficult as a major producer, supplier and transporter, trafficker of drugs, to avoid capture and to avoid getting your drugs seized. Now, at the moment, well, it was estimated in about 2004 by the then Prime Minister Tony Blair's strategy unit that we were intercepting maybe as much as 15% of all drugs coming into the country, and that was with the expenditure at that time. Now, they estimated that you need to stop about 80% to have any real impact on the market. And you can imagine the effort and costs that could be involved. In theory, you could divert all resources into law enforcement. But I suspect then that you'd still have a problem. Look at what's happening in Latin America. Over the years, we've seen a massive trade in cocaine come up through Miami across the Caribbean. A little bit of enforcement there simply results in the balloon effect, shifting the supply to Mexico, where we're seeing a huge battle going on for control of the lucrative market. These criminals can use submarines to evade capture. There's always another way of avoiding customs intervention, and that's what's been shown by the last 40 years. Really, however hard you try, you're not going to stop it. There is demand, there will be supply, because there's huge profit to be made.
If, for example, cannabis, this is what the conference is about today, was decriminalised, what differences would we see on our streets?
Well, you simply wouldn't have any or very, very little criminal activity with the associated violence. Criminals don't go to lawyers to solve disputes. They'll use violence to gain territory, to make sure that they get the bigger slice of the illicit market. So you'll see a removal of criminal activity. You would also ensure that the product that was produced was more to the taste of individuals. There's a lot of talk about skunk at the moment, but skunk is largely produced because criminals can produce five crops a year of the immature female plant, and that has much higher THC levels and lower CBD levels. And this means you've got a stronger and more harmful product simply because of prohibition. So if we move to a controlled and regulated system, the product itself would be much less harmful. It would be more medicinally beneficial. And what we'd also have is less glamour associated with the product, and it's quite likely that youngsters would therefore not be tempted to rebel by taking it.
What about the present economic climate? Because many people in Bristol are saying that because it's becoming more and more difficult to get jobs, particularly for youngsters, that actually the temptation is just to step straight into the criminal underworld, and there's plenty of work to be had there.
Well, at the moment, that's exactly the point under prohibition. If you've got a criminal market where the price is positioned so that you can make a profit and it's worth doing it against the risks of being caught, and frankly, most people aren't caught because there simply aren't sufficient law enforcement resources to achieve that. Sadly, under prohibition, there is an illicit market that youngsters are drawn into. They're drawn into it because money can be made, and it's probably an exciting lifestyle. And often, sadly, the role models, the successful people that they seek to emulate, are those who are successful in the illicit drugs market. It's a thoroughly reprehensible state of affairs that we could do something about if we controlled and regulated, rather than sticking with this failed, expensive and harmful prohibition that we have at the moment.
So do you envisage a sort of Dutch system where people will be able to go to Tesco's and buy cannabis?
Well, they can't go to Tesco's to buy cannabis. They actually go to cafes. And the Dutch system is that there is actually a lot of control and regulation of the product. You know exactly what you're getting. It is for adults only. And what you've actually got is about half the level of consumption of cannabis, and for that matter, heroin, in the Netherlands compared to the UK. What's interesting is if you actually look across the world, drug consumption seems to be independent of drug law enforcement. There are some countries with a lot of enforcement and low use, and some with a lot of enforcement and high use, and vice versa. What we're actually looking at is other factors such as income inequality, cultural issues.
So what does that tell you about why people take drugs?
Well, people take drugs for a whole range of reasons. They could take them for spiritual reasons, cultural reasons, for making music, for inspiration in art, and also, and this is where it becomes more problematic, people have got perhaps trauma from emotional, physical, sexual abuse as children, quite often do end up taking substances, alcohol, of course, tremendously, but also other substances that basically take the pain away. Now, this is not a desirable state of affairs, but if you are in a vulnerable position, and if perhaps you don't have a lot of self-control, and if there aren't other opportunities for you to engage yourself and fulfill yourself, then frankly, drugs, and I include alcohol and tobacco, are a way of making the world feel a softer, less harsh place. Now, happily, it's not everybody that takes drugs that falls prey to addiction. With cocaine, for example, it's probably about 15 or 16%. With alcohol, it's about 12%. And clearly, that's far too many, because you do end up with people who are in a desperate state of affairs. And frankly, they don't need to be criminalised. It's the last thing they need. They need to be helped and supported with the medical issues they face, and often, of course, the mental issues they face.
Now, locally, over the last 6 or 8 months, we've had quite a lot of busts of cannabis farms in the Avon and Somerset police area. Do you think this is a wise tactic? Because some might say, well, this just leaves the market open for international traders.
Well, I think what's happened over the last few years is that there has been a growth of domestic production in the UK, because once it's in the country, you haven't got to go through the process of trying to get it through customs, you know, across the borders from outside. There is still a trade from other parts of the world, but certainly you do have criminality associated with these grow houses, as they're often called. And I think it's a problem for the police. Again, I don't blame the police for doing the duty. I understand this. I was a police officer myself. But it seems to me a huge waste of resources for the police to be, you know, kicking doors in and closing down grow houses when we know that another one will grow up to meet the market. And what's actually happened is the big grow houses, barns and warehouses that were more common some years ago, are now being replaced by much smaller sort of entrepreneurial places. And you often get people, what might be termed ordinary citizens, otherwise law-abiding, who will just make some money by setting aside a room for growing cannabis. The police can really try all they like, and I appreciate they have to do it if they get complaints from residents, but again, it's like shoveling water. It's not going to stop the production and supply of cannabis, and it just seems to be completely wasteful, counterproductive and dispiriting. And it is dispiriting for many police who are engaged in this, because they're not stupid. They know it isn't having any impact on the market. So we really need political willpower to say, look, enough's enough. Let's review this. Let's listen to the Home Affairs Select Committee that said we should have a Royal Commission. And let's not carry on deluding ourselves to saying that everything's fine and prohibition's working when it clearly isn't.
Is it your experience that some police themselves who are charged with enforcing the law are actually taking two salaries, one from the government as a policeman and one from the drug cartels or drug dealers?
Well, it's interesting that I worked for a while as a detective superintendent in the Metropolitan Police Service in the Complaints Investigation Bureau, and it's quite clear that the majority of those officers who were corrupted, became corrupt, I'm not saying they didn't have a choice, were corrupted by the lure of drug money. I mean, if you're a detective sergeant earning 30,000, 40,000 a year, you kick down a door, or perhaps your detective constable does it for you, and on the table is 30,000 to 40,000 pounds, it becomes very tempting. And sadly, this is one of the problems associated with the fact that the criminals run the market, not the government. Drugs are simply not controlled at the moment, other than by criminals, and they're certainly not regulated. What you've got is a situation where there's so much money floating around that it's very easy and, of course, desirable for the criminals dealing in illicit drugs to corrupt the law enforcement officers whose duty it is to bring them to justice. Now, to be fair, it's a small minority, but it's more than we'd want, and that's partly because there's so much money available to criminals to corrupt law enforcement officials. And that happens all the world over, and that goes up to the highest level sometimes, where whole countries, so-called narco states, are corrupted by drug cartels. In this country, we have a pretty stable system. We have a pretty low level of corruption. I think I'm not quite sure where we stand on the international standings, but we've got something to be proud of. but there is too much of it, and it is an issue. And I think that prohibition, which creates the profits for the criminals, has a part to play in creating corruption.
Well, what tips detectives over the edge? This is a difficult one, isn't it? What tips them over the edge from being law-abiding, enforcing the law, to taking bribes?
You will always get people who, for whatever reason, could be personal circumstances, it could be a form of coercion, because these drug gangs are very powerful and they're used to using violence to get their way, and they do not want to go to prison. So you will get threats, intimidation, and you will also get the lure of a huge amount of money that turns just a very small number of people. It's human nature, it's human frailty, and the dealers will do what they can to avoid justice, and if that involves corrupting somebody, they will. But happily, it's only a few.
Tom Lloyd there is a former chief constable of Cambridgeshire, with some pretty shocking stuff. I mean, he's saying effectively that the current enforcement mechanism, Martin, by the police, the drug squad, the detectives that are doing the enforcement, is actually having zero impact on the drugs market.
Well, it's not having zero impact, it's moving things around, moving deck chairs around.
That's why he's saying as soon as there are drug busts, immediately new dealers will move in.
Yes, all right, let's take a step back and think about the politics of all of this. Western intelligence services have been involved in drug dealing since the 1940s. The CIA first got involved in drug dealing in the 1940s when the nationalist Chinese were losing the civil war inside China. They went back to the Democrat Congress inside the US and said, we want some money to fight the civil war in China. The politicians said, no, he's joking, we're not putting money up for that. And they were stuck in a bind. So they said, light bulb goes on in the brain, why don't we allow the nationalist Chinese to ship all of the heroin from the Golden Triangle, which is the sort of Burma, southwest China, we'll turn a blind eye and take it to America, we'll get our friends in the mafia to distribute it, and we'll pay for the Chinese nationalists that way. And that's what they did, and they've been doing it ever since. The Hmong in the Vietnam War were encouraged by the CIA to grow heroin to fund their anti-communist army, which the CIA were arming. The Mujahideen in Afghanistan during the 1980s, a lot of their funding came from drugs which ended up on the streets of places like Bristol, addicting people to heroin. But of course, this was all being given a blind eye by the intelligence services, and that's the piece of the jigsaw that's missing from our chief constable's analysis there. He's obviously a very decent man, he's obviously got lots of sensible common sense ideas, but he hasn't quite understood how deeply rooted this is. And when he says that Britain is the least corrupt country in the world, that is apart from the city of London, which actually probably washes more drug money than anywhere else on the planet. But of course, it's not counted as British corruption, it's corruption in the city of London, it's stuff moving around in the Cayman Islands.
Well, what evidence have you got for the city being a major drug laundering capital?
Because it's where the money is. Where does the product of all this drug dealing is money. Who has the most money? Where does the money go? It goes to the places. It's actually washed through things like the Cayman Islands, the British Virgin Islands, which is in fact the city of London. No money actually goes to the Cayman Islands. It's just moved around in computers. Now, the fact is that the Western intelligence services have been using drug dealing for many years. And what they do, of course, is that the DEA, for example, the Drug Enforcement Administration in Latin America, what they do is go after drug cartels and drug dealers who are not cooperating with the CIA. So the Medellin cartel and Pablo Escobar were not cooperating with the Americans, so he was rubbed out. The Cali cartel were cooperating with the Alto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, which is the right-wing paramilitaries in Colombia, and they were basically winked at and allowed to do whatever they wanted. The fight that's going on in Mexico at the moment is not to crush drug dealing, it's to crush Los Zetas cartel, which the Americans don't like, and another cartel whose name I've forgotten, which they do like, because this is the politics of drug cartels.
But Martin, what we were hearing earlier from Rowan Bosworth Davis, this is I'm starting to get deja vu here, because he was saying that the banking system was synonymous, in fact, actually equal with organised crime. Now you're telling me that the intelligence services again are linking up with organised crime.
Yes, because the thing from an intelligence...
I mean, isn't it organised crime running things, ultimately, in the banking and the drugs?
Yes, what we've got is a criminalised ruling class running the whole of capitalism. Virtually everything they do is crooked, and because they're all doing it, we can't arrest some of them because we'd have to arrest all of them, therefore we can't arrest anybody, therefore we're in a situation where the criminals continue to prosper.
Anyway,
but ultimately, we will have to change this.
But Marina Morris has been out on the streets, and our final little item this week is, what do you think? Obviously, most people are a bit confused about what is the difference between prohibition and decriminalisation. But anyway, let's see what you've got to say.
Should cannabis use be legalised? It depends, really. I know it's used for some cancer patients, and often people who've tried to sort after it for their wives or loved ones have been, you know, jailed and things. I think there should be exceptions on certain things, but I think it depends on the situation, really. If it does help people in the last, you know, 6 months of their life, and it helps them get through pain, I mean, there's a lot of drugs that are even prescription drugs. Drugs shouldn't people drink or abuse them and take it. So I think it's kind of worms, really.
I think there could be many pros and cons to it. It could be taxed, it could be controlled. Lots of other areas that are very much attached to people's lifestyle that are intertwined with that can be helped and removed from the situation. So whether I'd say yes or no, because there's lots of downsides for people, I'm not going to say yes or no, but I'm not sure.
I think cannabis should be legalised. I don't see it doing much harm.
No, definitely no way. Too many problems now. I think you'd get more problems if it was legalised.
I think it leads on to bigger things.
Worse things, yeah. Not enough control over it.
Should drugs be prohibited or controlled?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. It's such a difficult thing, though. It's not a problem that's going to go away. It's been here for centuries. And there's always a new craze, isn't there? There's always a new something replaces something else. As people want to go through drugs to survive it, and they think, I want a better high or something, I want to experience something else. And I think it should be restricted, and especially for kids, because that's where it starts from. I made a choice. I'm not saying I haven't taken drugs, but I made the choice very early that not to. Some people have got that switch to saying, no, it's not for me, but some people don't. And they use an addiction to replace some sort of pain or something in their life. So you can't put it down to just like a question, should it be prohibited? Because I don't think it ever will, but it should be for certain.
Control to a certain extent, there's always going to be a black market or other ways of getting hold of things. Control is probably the most advantageous and progressive choice for our society.
Prohibited, yes. Illegal drugs, yes.
Some of these ones, cocaine, heroin, ketamine, ecstasy, they should definitely be still prohibited. But I don't see the problem with cannabis, personally. But I know that some of those other things lead to severe personality disorders. Cannabis can do that as well, especially in young people. But it's all about attitude, so I think if it became a little bit more controlled and less prohibited, cannabis I mean, it would be easier to deal with those problematic youngsters who maybe do it too much.
Do you know people whose lives have been affected by drugs?
Oh yeah, I know lots of people. I'm a musician, I used to play in bands. It affects everybody the same. It doesn't matter if you're the millionaire rock star or the guy who's had an horrible experience who sleeps in the park every night. It's that the millionaire rock star can afford better stuff and probably get it quicker. And it has the same devastating effect on families as well, really, like any addiction, really.
So the problems go on with the drugs. I just have to cut that, I'm afraid, because of the apologies for the mistake with Tom Lloyd's interview from the former Chief Constable of Cambridgeshire. Time to sign off now, because next is Cyrus the Virus. He really is here this week. I announced him the last couple of weeks, and he wasn't here, but he is this week. Typical topical up next. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summerson, to Rowan Bosworth Davies. Next week, Vince Cable threatens again to set off the Royal Mail, and the Queen apparently doesn't give a fig.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a teacher who ran away to France with a 15-year-old pupil has been jailed.